Good evening. Welcome to the Refinery. I am Fishy, Felicia Cravens. We are so glad you are here for the show where we talk about the oil business and everything involved in refining petroleum and all that wonderful stuff.
No. Fishy.
Okay.
You got the job to substitute host, please.
Okay, this is The Refinery, the show where we rant about everything that we're angry about all the time.
No, Fishy. No? We're going to fire you and get Leslie back because, you know, she's had a rough day. We thought that you could sub in.
I can do this. I know my lines. Okay, here we go. Welcome to The Refinery, the show you love because we tell you exactly what you want to hear about.
No.
Fine.
Try it again.
All right. Time. Good evening. Welcome to The Refinery. It is Thursday, not even Thursday. It's Tuesday, and it's March 24th, and we are here with grassroots organizations that don't get much more grassroots than the Party of Choice, Free Radical Network, and the Conservative Union, where we come together to explore the best ways to advance conservative messaging and to make it work and to reach and influence more people. We're live via Google Hangout right now and text chat at therefinerieshow.com. You can go and check us out there. You can also find us on all these podcasts that are listed on the show as well, including the Vigilant Liberty Radio podcast. And tonight, we have a full show. I am, again, I said, Felicia Cravens, Fishy, with the Free Radical Network. Joining me from Free Radical Network as well, J.D. Bryden and Peter Rehm and George Templeton. So we are outnumbering everybody tonight. From the Conservative Union, we have Ryan Bickmore and Leslie Price, who has had a hard day, and apparently now it just made it worse because I screwed up all the intro. And we have joining us from the Party of Choice, Corey and Andy Pate. And guys, we are starting off tonight with life. Life is great. Life is beautiful. And everybody that we've seen on the right that comes and pushes and pitches the pro-life stance, it's had an impact. We've seen a lot of people coming around to our point of view. The pro-life position is gaining popularity, but that's not to say that every way that you share that message is helpful. And to go into that, I'm hoping that JD has some of the images attached to a post that Corey started by sharing today. I'm going to let Corey really talk about this story. I think it resonates really well with what the Party of Choice is doing, and we'll pick up again to messaging on it later from an article that the Party of Choice has out. But let's let Corey start it.
All right, sounds good. Yeah, I found this article this morning, and it just really kind of struck me that a lot of times in the pro-life movement, we get very passionate about what we believe, and we're so upset about the atrocities that are happening that we forget about our audience. And the people that you're going to meet on their way into an abortion clinic are usually young women who are distraught already. They're unsure of themselves. They aren't confident that it's the right decision, or maybe they're an emotional mess. And there are some who are going to be very callous towards the decision that they're making. But when we show up with these, you know, pictures of bloody babies and things, I just wonder how many opportunities we lose to start conversations with these women who are hurting and scared. So what I really liked about this particular blog was that it was written from a secular perspective, and JD's putting up a picture right now of how not to do it. But anyway, this blog was talking about these signs and how they turn people off, especially those who are from a secular worldview, and how if they were to be approached, they would want someone to be approaching them with, "I want to help you," or "I'm here for you," offering a true alternative instead of just yelling "baby killer." And so anybody who's familiar with the Party of Choice knows that we are very pro-life, and Andy's done some sessions on YouTube on how to explain those beliefs. But it's really important that we don't give the impression that we just think these women are baby killers. and Andy can actually explain that a little bit better than I can. we won't get into it now because we've talked about it several times.
Right. I'm sorry. I don't want to break in here because I have the picture up, and I want to put it up. This is an example of the bad, the way that you don't want to do it. This is hopefully it's showing to everyone there. This is the wrong example. This is something that we from Free Radical Network got to see in person at CPAC 2013. This was driving around the streets there at National Harbor, and the question is, to me at least, what are we doing here? What is this achieving? How is this helping our cause, particularly when you're going to be driving around CPAC? Who are you going to convert there? Who are you going to shop there? Who hasn't already seen these horrible images a ton of times?
Right, and when you're driving around with this pickup truck that's plastered with billboard-sized signs that say repent and show these horrible things that are going on, you know, I've been actually in a meeting with some pro-lifers where they were, that this was their strategy. They were discussing how they could get their hands on the most atrocious pictures possible and get them blown up into huge signs and go pick it outside of abortion clinics. And they thought that that would be an effective way to shock young women into changing their minds.
You know, it's, once again, not considering your audience. One big reason a young woman is going to have an abortion is because she feels judged by society at getting pregnant, or by her family, or by, you know, or by her friends. And they see her growing, and there's no way, you know, the guy who helped cause the pregnancy looks the same. The girl is growing, okay, and can't hide it. And so she's already feeling judged for the stigma. She's already feeling looked at. She's already feeling, you know, called out in that way. And so when you put up signs like that, you're letting her know we're judging you further. The first thing they need to know is this: I'm not judging you. I value you. You're wonderful. You're valuable. You're precious. It's not just the life inside you that's precious. You're precious. Okay?
Oh, go ahead. Certainly would have been something that I would have welcomed to hear from someone when I was in that situation. It's not something that, from 25 years ago, 26 years ago, things were a little bit different in terms of socially how that's been accepted, or you know, it's different for women now. But the question's the same. Do you feel as though everyone, you know, looks at you and knows that you're a miserable failure at whatever society's expectations were, and then what do you do? And it's so easy for young women to say, I'm just not going to deal with it. I'm going to, you know, take care of it as a problem, look at it as something needing a solution. But it makes a difference. And, you know, some people say, you know, the shame is a powerful thing and we should bring that back. And I understand where they're coming from, but I don't know that that was ever an honest, effective thing as far as changing someone's heart. I think
love the sinner and hate the sin.
There you go.
Love the sinner and hate the sin. And the other thing is, look how shrill the left is about abortion. The fact that they put out T-shirts that say, that celebrate, I had an abortion. And just all kinds of other just really horrifying things. Stuff like that van, that earlier picture you showed, to me, that cancels that out. We want the left to be the shrill ones. We want the left to be celebrating something as heinous as not just abortion, but partial birth abortion. We don't want to be as shrill and as nasty as them, because, as you said, this is a terribly difficult situation for young women to be in. And I would prefer there be, you know, abortion be very restricted. We have to understand that somebody that's going in there is going in there most of the time because they don't feel like they have any options. Yes, there are people who are sociopathic who are just like, this is an inconvenience and I want rid of it. But I heard a story at church on Sunday of a lady that stopped by, that was walking by the church and was told by her husband, if you don't get an abortion, I'm going to leave you. And she just walked into my pastor's office and talked to him about it and got her to talk her out of it and was able to, you know, help her get to the point where she decided to have the child instead of having the abortion. And the husband didn't leave her, and the child's grown up, 18 years old, was about to go to college. And that was an amazing story. And there are all sorts of Christian charities that do that, that focus on that end of it. And that's where, as conservatives, we need to be. Love the sinner, hate the sin. Understand where these women are and how desperate they are, and let's move them and let's convince them in a loving and positive way, like what Andy said, to not make a choice like that.
Well, and that's what the article over on Secular Pro-Life did. It showed examples like this one that's on the screen right now. You can stop and talk to me. I was a teen mom. I've been there before. That picture, as well as a few others. Let me find. Here we go. That's another great one. There's another way. We will help you find it. This is an example of one of those charities out there that it helps people out. It shows that there's more than just the one solution. You know, a grim and bloody solution. There are actual positive ways to handle that, and it's so much nicer, so much friendlier, and so much more hopeful than the condescending and damning way that the abortion mobile strategy, you know, is applied. And I say this as a person who I've actually written about the value of shock in arguments and using these images. And I do think that there is a time and a place for them, but it's not driving down Main Street, and it does not age or cause there. That's not where it's going to be the most effective.
Well, I think it comes down to sales and marketing tactics, which, you know, as a messaging type of organization, that's what we're here to help people figure out. And we do want to adopt and adapt the tactics of the effective tactics of the left, and we see that they are effectively using horrifying images and shock to persuade people. And so some people end up kind of halfway getting the message and halfway learning the tactic, and what they get is, we need to use shocking and appalling images to get their attention. But there's a very real difference. When the left uses the shocking and appalling images of bloodied baby seals, they're showing shocking and appalling images of something that somebody else is doing, and they want you to join them and fight against that. So it's the horrible thing is out there, done by someone else who will be our common enemy, and we will fight against the people who are doing these horrible, horrible things. But with abortion, and if you're showing these horrible, horrible images, the person that you're selling to is the person that you're trying to make guilty for creating and being the perpetrator of these horrible images. So you're kind of missing the boat. You're trying to sell to the person that you're accusing of being evil. And I can't convince you to join my team if I've just called you a murderer. And I can convince you to join my team if I have helped you in your time of need, or if I have persuaded you that there is a beautiful, loving choice and alternative, and if I'm showing you wonderful pictures of the 3D ultrasounds of what your baby looks like, and that isn't that beautiful, and don't you want to be the creator of this beautiful thing, and then be so brave and so generous that you give birth to this beautiful baby, and then you give it up for adoption so that somebody who has wanted a baby now has this baby, and you did this for them, and you are a hero forever for this child. Now you've just gotten somebody to join you in the anti-abortion movement, because you've gotten them to join you by helping them create beauty. and you're not, because if you're using the shock images on the abortion, you're creating an enemy because you're telling the person who's going to commit the abortion that they're a, you're saying that they're the baby seal murderer, and that baby seal murderer is never going to be on your side. See how it's we're kind of twisting and halfway using the leftist tactic of the shocking pictures? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I
got to say this. It kind of reminded me, when I was reading this article, I spent the week listening to 4.5 hours of debate from the Texas Senate on open carry. What does that have in common, you might ask? But think about the legislation on open carry in Texas is getting pushback. All of the resistance I was hearing was from people's reaction to seeing guns in the public. The two issues we are winning on more than any other are life and guns. Seems ironic, but it's true. And yet we have people fighting for both things that use this sort of messaging or that do things that put off people who would naturally be supportive of the causes. And I think it goes back to something like our New Year's resolution, remember your audience. If your whole goal is just to vent and to say things, that's fine, but don't pretend that you're being helpful. You have to really think about where you're going and what you're saying and to whom.
I think a big mistake we make is that we feel that we have to, either with our signs or a quick message, shove into her head the idea of valuing that child. And newsflash for everyone, that and I say this in my videos, that young woman is not the most pro-choice person around. The most pro-choice person around is the guy who got her pregnant. Because she at least has feelings of nurture. He only has feelings of escape. So understand, she already has the feelings of nurture. The reason she's getting the abortion is because of, obviously she's afraid of going through the 9 months of the pregnancy and all that, of course. But a lot of it is she's afraid of the social rejection. She's afraid of the social judgment. And so my only message that I want her to get right up front, right there, she already knows I'm pro-life. She already knows that, I think there's a life inside her. Forget that. I want her to know one thing. I'm not going to value you more if you agree with me, or less if you don't. And so my only message, if I had a sign, would be this. Whatever you choose, you're precious to me. Something like that. Just basically, whatever you choose, you're precious to me. Because I'm assuming already she has feelings of nurture, unlike the guy who, took off. All right? And that, because that gives a better chance of her wanting to discuss than me trying to shove into her head this notion, my views on the preciousness of life.
I liked what Leslie said a few minutes ago about adoption, about appealing to the woman and, the beautiful thing growing inside of her. You could do such a selfless thing and carry the baby to term and give it up for adoption to a family who has wanted a baby but for some reason cannot have one. I think people are... I think people are mostly good, and I think we as conservatives think that people are incredible. They're capable of selfless things. They're capable of amazing, innovative, incredible things. And I think if we appeal to that kind of basic nature in people that, you want to do good, you want to help people, you want to serve people, that's a natural thing. And by appealing to that, look at all the good you could do. Look how much of a difference you could make in someone's life who's been trying to adopt a kid and have a kid for years. I have friends right now that are going through that. They've been trying to have kids through any way they can for 4 or 5 years now, and they haven't been able to. I'm sure they'd love to be able to adopt, but it's so hard to go through that right now. And I think that will help make them want to carry the baby to term, give it to someone for adoption, make them feel better about themselves, what they're going through, not as ashamed. And I think it's a lot more effective than trying to scare people with images like JD was showing at the beginning.
Well, and yeah, instead of just don't do a bad thing, we can help persuade people to doing something good and challenging them to be the hero to that baby in there. I do want to say that the background noise while you were speaking, Ryan, indicates that you might be a little bit biased in favor of babies. Because Baby Bickmore was there in the background giving Baby Bickmore's perspective on it, which is
awesome. Yes, I had to leave because he started talking.
No, that's just a DVD he plays. That's like Sounds of Nature.
Absolutely.
When I personally, Ryan, that's a pretty cheap appeal. Okay?
Yeah, just, really emotional tactics. Really.
Just go on your own talent, okay?
You know, I will say I noticed that it sort of tied together when Fishy was talking the abortion thing and then the Texas open carry. You know, the conservative movement are two most successful concepts, and the ones that we're most strong on is pro-life and pro-Second Amendment. And those are both very concrete things that we do and are very staunch about that are in favor of protecting the helpless and helping those who are less fortunate than us, because we want them to be as safe and protected as we are. We want them to be as alive as we are. We need to remember that the left may brag about caring about the poor and the needy, but the right actually does care about the poor and the needy and the helpless. And we fight for them. And so does the Constitution, with the rights to life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, and all the guns you can possibly afford. So, I just think we need to remind ourselves and others that our staunch stands on anti-abortion and pro-Second Amendment are in favor of the helpless and equal justice, shall we say, or equalizing the opportunity for justice for those who are less fortunate, don't have the personal bodyguards and the tall fences. They can get a gun.
Absolutely. While we're talking about advocacy, Andy, you have a new article out up on partyofchoice.com.
Yeah, it's basically looking at Hillary's upcoming campaign, and I call it Our Campaign Against Advocacy. And what I do is I lead it off with what Hillary recently said. She said to a group of women, Democrat women, "Don't you someday want to see a woman president of the United States of America?" And so what she did is she positioned herself firmly as she's going to be an advocate. Okay, and she even says she's going to be an advocate of women's rights, which is ironic, of course, since she underpaid people in her office, but I'll leave that be. The underpaid women. I believe that this is a tremendous opening for the right, and here's why. People are sick of the advocacy. We will have had 8 years of an advocate-in-chief instead of a leader. 8 years of a president who represents various factions of our society rather than leading all of our society. And people are tired of it. They've seen the favoritism. They've seen, a Justice Department that cracks down heavily and does enormous investigations every time a person of color is killed by a white person and ignores all the times it goes the other way. They've seen the bias. And to hear somebody else come out and say, "I'm going to be an advocate," they don't like that. And so what I do is I basically go into what should be our strategy. And to sum it up, our best strategy is not the worst. Well, the worst strategy is to go against her advocacy with our advocacy. All right? Oh, yeah, well, here's our conservative advocacy stuff. If you fight advocacy with advocacy, that makes hers look okay. You've got a whole country that's sick and tired of all these warring, whining factions. And if you just become another one of them, you cancel yourself out and people are not going to look at her. What you do is you come out against advocacy in general and say, "Look, what we want is individualism." Okay, if you want to call me an advocate, sure, I'm an advocate for all individuals. But we're not going to play group against group. I love my religious beliefs. I don't want them to be your laws, okay? I don't want schools forcing your kids to learn my values, my politics, my views on sex. Can Democrats say the same? In other words, show how we in the right want all people to be able to choose their own issues that matter to them, and not use the highest office in the land to shove our advocacy down their throat and basically expose them. I've done this with people, by the way, and it really works well. It makes the left look terrible. A lot of fun.
Should we...
Yes?
Unmute yourself, George. Sorry.
I was gonna ask, should we use the term division and divisiveness whenever she brings that up? Should we talk?
Sure.
She talks about being the first woman. Should we accuse her, or should we go after her as somebody who's trying to divide people?
Sure. Absolutely. And I would basically say, notice that she, you know what? I don't want to pit group against group. I'll tell you right now, I've got groups. I'm a right-wing, evangelical, born-again Christian. Tea partier. Okay? See all my groups there? I don't want my groups to win over your groups. I want all individuals to have opportunity. You see, I don't want to divide. Why is she dividing us? With all this divisive language, you can't lead people while dividing them. You have to want what's best for all of them. Okay? And so, does that make sense? Okay, so what I basically...
What you're saying then is that there's not going to be anybody to advocate for my free pizza days? Is that what you're telling me, Ryan?
Those are bad for you. God told me they're bad
for you. I'll advocate for you, Brass. I firmly believe in the party of free pizza.
I think that we should redistribute George's pizza that he just got to Peter, because then Peter will like me more.
You're going to tax my pizza more?
No. I'm not going to tax your pizza.
Wait a minute. Is this Rich?
I'm voting for Jersey now. Sorry, George. Can I have my pizza now?
Wait. He's going to confiscate my pizza, not tax it. Excuse me. He's going to confiscate my pizza.
Yes,
it's redistribution. It's redistribution of the pizza to those that need it. Like
shared
me.
Sacrifice, people. Shared
I don't
sacrifice.
Like anchovies. I'd make sure I get anchovies on my pizza so nobody would want it but me.
From if you want your anchovies, your anchovies.
He's like a 1% hiding his wealth overseas. That's what he's doing here. This anchovies thing. We're gonna find that pizza, George. We're gonna take the anchovies off of it, and we're going to share it out.
If he wants his anchovies, he can keep his anchovies.
Anchovy privilege is not allowed. Ban it.
Yeah, and you know what? I don't know if now is the right time to go for it, but you know what? Since we're in the banning mood, I think that we have to get into this and talk about what happened in New York. And from the same town that brought you the ban on 64-ounce Coca-Colas comes the war on kids. I mean, it's amazing that you go from Michael Bloomberg, who wants to ban trans fats and salt and, you know, large sodas and, you know, a slew of other things, to Bill de Blasio, who has already made it so that it is illegal. If you are a daycare, you cannot let kids drink more than six ounces. Is it 6 ounces? Let me double check my notes here. I think it actually was reduced down from 6 ounces. Yeah. The old rules allowed babies as young as 8 months to guzzle 6 ounces of 100% of juice a day. No, now they are only allowed 4 ounces of 100% juice, and it has to be 100% juice. Any other juice, if you're talking about high C, you're out of luck. You cannot, if you are a daycare, you just throw out all that high C that you have. Throw out the Capri Sun, you're done. You have to get only the best 100% juice, and anything else is not allowed. Not only that, not only are they banning that in New York for daycares, they are making it so that kids can only have less than 30 minutes of sedentary time. These little kids collapse at random intervals. They do stuff, and then they stop
Dickens
doing stuff.
I think Dickens wrote a few books about that sort of thing, didn't he?
About what?
About children who didn't have, who weren't allowed sedentary time by their elders. Dickens wrote some books like Great Expectations, Pippin, that sort of thing.
Has anybody talked to Lance Armstrong about this whole juice and exercise thing?
Why does he hate the Jews? I mean, is it because of Netanyahu being reelected?
You were going to have whole choruses of Oliver Twist and New York Kids. More, please.
Oliver Twist, that's what it was. Not David Copperfield. Not, and certainly not the magician. Great Expectations.
Ryan makes a great point, though. This also excludes Kool-Aid. And so perhaps, Ryan?
That was awesome. He unmutes his mic and his loud marks.
No, that was the boy saying da.
Oh, that was the boy. Okay.
Yeah.
He's advocating for New York toddlers.
Yeah. It's too loud around here. You'll have to say this.
No, he just said that there's there's Kool-Aid would be eliminated from this because it's not 100% juice. It's not any percent juice, so perhaps that means they can't drink the Obama Kool-Aid.
There's no more Kool-Aid drink. Yeah.
If a mayor got between me and my Capri Sun when I was in elementary school, even though I was about 7 or 8, I would have at least kicked him in the knees.
Hawaii,
orange.
Nobody can get through between me and my Capri Sun. Ever.
The only reason I knew how to use one of those pointy can openers is because my mom got the high C in the metal can, and I would come home from school and I'd open the can and I would stand at the refrigerator and guzzle it down out of the thing. So that may explain a lot.
How about a nice Hawaiian punch? That was mine. I loved that tropical fruit, tropical punch flavor. That was some stuff. I think this is a Juicy Juice lobby thing, because Juicy Juice is always advertising that it's 100% juice.
That could be. Well, T is saying that in Connecticut, they're going to tax soda according to ounces of sugar in the big bottles and extra taxes on candy. New York got their idea from Connecticut. Connecticut passed a bill to eliminate chocolate milk and juices, but Governor Malloy vetoed it last year. Now, is that the same Governor Malloy who is touted as the possible competition for Queen Hillary?
No, that's O'Malley.
Oh, that's O'Malley.
Maryland.
Yeah. Who taxed Rain, by the way?
All the Democrats seem alike to me. Of course, Malloy may not even be a Democrat. I'm sorry, I've had a long day.
No, he's a Democrat. We're talking about Connecticut.
Connecticut?
How many people are going to be left in New York when de Blasio is kicked out of office?
There should be
just droves of people leaving.
There are two electoral seats that Texas added in the 2010 census, and guess where they came from? I'm just saying.
New York?
Absolutely.
No, California.
Tang. Oh, my gosh, Tang. That was space age. You know, back when having space age things was your marketing tactic.
Oh, Tang was the best.
I'm regretting seriously bringing this story up. Because we've gone into the deep end of
old people reminiscing. Is that what you're talking
disgusting
about?
Disgusting beverages from the 80s. I don't want to. Tang is nasty. I don't think anyone. The last can of a container of that powdered nastiness was created. I don't know.
Yeah,
in the 50s, and they just continued selling it.
But your generation has its terrible drinks. Those energy drinks are nasty. Red Bull and all of that, those things are disgusting.
And Tang was space age, man.
Exactly.
That was so right.
Astronauts drink it. It was for real. Every generation has its nasty kids' drinks, apparently.
Moon dust in it.
I will continue to drink my kombucha and look down on you guys. So.
Hipster.
Okay, I'll be stupid. What is kombucha? I've heard the word before, I just don't know what it is.
See, I don't know why I hang out with you people. I'm not going to explain it if you don't know what kombucha
is. Fermented tea.
So
everybody
knows.
You know
what? When I leave tea out on the counter, the next day I throw it out.
You're not a hipster.
You leave it out long enough that it ferments? That's gross, man. That's just gross.
Actually, they grow bacteria in it that's what makes it ferment.
Yes, yes, that's.
So
that's,
it's like tea that's becoming a loaf of bread.
Yes.
You know, if you want to be all, you know,
sciencey
Texas
and stuff, yeah.
about it, that's fine.
No, it's being sciencey. Sorry if that throws you for a loop.
Can we point out to little kids, by the way, how much the Democrats want to spoil their fun? You can't play on the playground. You cannot play on the playground because if you do and you get hurt, you're going to sue somebody or whatever.
But you can't let your kids walk to the park.
You can't have Capri Sun. I presume you can't have cake in school ever anymore, or cupcakes, or candy, or any of these sorts of things. Because it used to be you could get candy out of the candy machine. I'm sure they banned that.
But isn't it funny that they're reducing sedentary time for toddlers, but in elementary school, they are eliminating school education classes?
Well, and Hillary's talking about sending adults to camp. So it's all kinds of mixed up as far as kids can't be kids. They have to act like adults or something. Really? But then once you're an adult, you're supposed to act like a kid. I don't even get it. They don't even make sense anymore.
I really hope she's not talking about the kind of adult camps that Bill frequented on the private jet with his friend on that private island.
Ooh, pedo parties. Oh, my God.
Ew, 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 stop. Ew, ew.
Sorry, we brought up the war on children. Leslie brought up happy camps. The two go together.
Can we get through a show without being overtly sexual about these things? It's disgusting. It's horrible.
Probably not.
We are not going to go into the adult daycare story, but oh my stars, people. This nation is completely upside down.
Yeah. All right, but let's get back on track here and talk about a different story that's obnoxious and annoying. I'm sure people know this past week there was an uproar, brouhaha over Iowa, crying about something that one of Scott Walker's people tweeted out, just complaining about Iowa. I mean, it's Iowa. You can complain about Iowa because it's Iowa. I mean, wah is at the end of Iowa.
I got four words.
Yeah.
Children of the corn.
Yeah, pretty much. Children of the corn subsidies, at least. There have been a lot of stories about.
I should have had the sound effects ready for that.
But I'm on the producer. I don't know if it works for you. I don't know if you can do that. If it would
okay,
play.
Let's use that as my excuse. Okay.
Anyway, George, actually, you wrote an article about that went up today.
Yeah. Yes, I did, and I was just frustrated because I am a Scott Walker fan. In fact, the first time I was on this show and crashed this show, I was sort of touting Scott Walker as a potential great candidate for us if he'd won re-election, which he did. And I know of Liz Mayer. I don't know her personally, but I know of her because I think she's had some connections to the Virginia blogosphere going way back. She's very good at her job. And when I saw the morning that she was hired, that she was hired by Walker, I was very excited about this. Now, I didn't like her tweets about Iowa, and I don't like, even though I'm not a big fan of Iowa and New Hampshire going first in the GOP primary, the snobbery that comes from certain Beltway class folks about those states really bothers me. That said, hiring somebody in the morning and then forcing them to resign in the evening is a terrible look, no matter what way you slice it. Because either you didn't vet her properly, which is insane to me that could happen, because for me, and I don't know, I've never worked on a campaign, but I would think of it this way. If you're working on a presidential campaign, your candidate is going to be vetted to a fairly well. They're going to literally turn his guts inside out, and that's the kind of vetting process it is. So if that's going to happen to your candidate, shouldn't you really have to when you're hiring them? Shouldn't you comb through absolutely everything that you can comb through? And that is tweets and Facebook and any other social media platform and whatever, you know, whatever it is. You should be combing through all of it, and you should expect that if you're going to be hired by one of these folks. So they didn't vet Liz Mayer, and it's not like her tweets are hidden. It's not like you couldn't find them. It's not like you couldn't dig them up. They're tweets. They're Twitter. Twitter's been around for how many years now? It's not exactly hard to comb through somebody's tweets, especially if you're going to hire them and they have their tweets locked. You can say, please let me be able to see all your tweets. So that part really disturbs me, but I don't know what's worse, the fact that they didn't do the vetting properly, or even worse, you hire a person, and then what, 12 hours later, she's forced to resign because you're worried about what some folks in Iowa are saying. And I like Steve King. Let me make something clear. I like Steve King. He and I have agreed on a lot over the years. I think he's a very good congressman. But Steve King shouldn't be picking your staff. He shouldn't be picking your platform. And you don't bow and scrape to anyone. I know Iowa's central to Scott Walker's strategy, and I know he's got a win there. But you don't bow and scrape to anyone because it is a bad look for all the other voters you got to convince.
Well, all of them. So that's my question. Something that came up on Twitter the night that this all happened was the general consensus among people who are in the blogosphere on the right, who are, you know, some of them have worked campaigns and are tied to campaigns or have been in the past and worked for candidates before, that by the standards that the Iowa complainers were setting, and, you know, whatever you think about what Liz Mayer tweeted or whatever is irrelevant here, but by those standards that those guys are setting up, most of us wouldn't be able to be employed. And there's an article in Red State as well on this, and that it was fueled not just from Iowa, but from certain people in the conservative media who were couching the fact that they had already eliminated Walker as a candidate in the terms of, oh, well, he needs much more vetting. That was sort of the take the author, Leon Wolf, had talked about. And he walks through the strategy that what we do every time, we seem to do over and over, is that we get to a place where we eliminate these guys one at a time until the only ones left standing are the Jeb Bushes and folks like that. And is that really what we're going to do again this go-round?
And I just want to add this too. Liz Mayer, okay, she said what she said. You stick behind her. You don't just earn her loyalty. You earn the loyalty of a lot of people that probably agree with her. And that's important. This is going to be this is such a fine margin. I mean, we're going to have 10, 15, however many candidates running, and it's probably going to be 1 or 2% difference who's going to win these caucuses, at least these early primaries, before we start winnowing the candidates down. So Scott Walker, you think Steve King's tough? It's going to get a lot worse. If you make it to the general, Steve King attacking you and other people attacking you is going to seem like small potatoes compared to what the mainstream media is going to come up with, and Hillary Clinton, if it's she that is the nominee for the Democratic Party. So you got to have to be a little bit tougher than that. The tenacity is there, and we know that it's there. Don't fold on stuff like this.
Well, I think, you know, and this early in the process, I mean, Scott Walker hadn't even declared yet. This early in the process, this is the time for the candidates to make mistakes like this, and Scott Walker made a mistake. It's the time for our candidates to learn to reject the premise of the question, and particularly against our own guys, when our Iowa people are being unreasonable, you just respond that it's my opinions that matter, not my staff. Thank you. Yes, I'm well aware of the things that the people I have hired have said. I hired her to do a job. She's going to do that job. And it's my ideas and my opinions about the wonderful people of Iowa that matter, not hers. And now we'll move on to a topic that I really want to talk about. Scott Walker needs to learn how to handle the press in that way. He needs to learn how to handle objections in that way. And that, you know, that's fine and wonderful for me to tell somebody else what they need to learn. But what I need to learn and what I need to keep reminding myself of is to gently criticize our side, because we have a battle on our side coming up between 15 to 20 valid, strong competitors, and we're each going to have our own preferences, and we're going to have to argue on behalf of our preferences and argue against the other guys. But we can and must do so without destroying our side and each other, and without making enemies out of each other. And because what we did last time, 4 years ago, 2 years ago, whatever, whenever it was we made enemies out of each other and we attacked each other. And the left is more than happy to see us and help us do it. And they will be trolling us and taunting us and guiding us into the attacks on our own side. And we have to guard ourselves against that. And that means that when we discuss this Walker thing as we're doing, we look at it and we discuss it, you know, in all of its glory and ugliness, but we do have to remember this doesn't mean that Walker is toast. God, nobody's toast yet. Nobody's even a loaf of bread yet. They're all just like dough in the pan. Wow, I'm really on bread today. It's, you started with pizza, and I started thinking deep dish, bread.
Well, technically, Ted Cruz is a loaf of bread now.
Oh, and you know, the point that you bring up there with Cruz, interestingly, Cruz is, you know, his first week out, getting slammed by the left in the media, and I've seen people who support other candidates actually calling BS on those attacks very strongly. And I've got to say, that to me bodes very well for what's coming.
I hope so. I mean, I hope that's the case. I hope that we have some unity here going into the 2016 election. And we have, I mean, by all accounts, these guys like each other. I mean, I don't think that there's any real feud between, like, Rand Paul and Ted Cruz, or Ted Cruz and Scott Walker, or Scott Walker and Rand Paul, or any of the other, you know.
Although I've seen a headline that Rand Paul and Ted Cruz are fighting against each other that is triggered by and goaded by the left, or bloggers on our side that need the clicks and the reads on their articles. We're going to have to guard against that, because there are people stoking for a fight, and that's clickbait. And we're going to fall for it to our detriment.
Well, and I think the bigger problem, I haven't really seen so much of the nastiness between candidates, even with our recent elections here in Colorado. I didn't see a whole lot of personal attacks going back and forth between the people who were running. But my bigger concern are the big-name media hosts like Rush Limbaugh and others who make a living, like you're saying, attacking people or ranting and raving, and we're starting to see it even, you know, on the different news outlets. But if we remember, for months, Rush Limbaugh was just going on and on and on about how Romney was the most evil person on the planet, and then all of a sudden he was our nominee. And so he had to eat all those words and try to get people to rally behind Romney, and it didn't work. Too late.
Yeah, and one of the stories that we actually took off of the list was that Glenn Beck is no longer a Republican, in case anybody cares.
Well, before you get into that, I have one more thing I wanted to add on this whole Iowa thing. I realize for a lot of people it seemed like she got hired one day and then got fired the same day or the next. I actually saw some stuff online from one of the people that I'm friends with on Facebook. And the on their timeline, somebody shared or something like that. It's like, be careful who your friends are, and basically warned about this gal, saying that she was pro-amnesty and pro-this, and so Walker, by default, was these things. And I think that when we start looking at every, you know, I agree, who you associate with does tend to paint who you are, but I thought that was a little far to go in terms of, hey, she's pro-amnesty, therefore, by default, Walker's pro-amnesty. And I felt like, you know, this is going to get ugly if we don't put a stop to it and quickly. I think that if you take a look at the way Rand Paul and Scott Walker and Ted Cruz deal with each other individually, I think you would find they probably get along quite famously. And that whoever the candidate would be, you know, if it was one of those three, that they would all, that the other two would back them and staunchly. So I think that the real infighting is going to come amongst supporters of, say, Ted Cruz, saying, sorry, Walker's too much of an establishment Republican. I think that you're going to hear that from people. And to me, I'm like, vet them all. and don't let there be a nasty fight. I realize that George Templeton is saying that Jeb Bush would get nasty, but do the vetting process and let people vote their conscience and then take the candidate that's the best and pray to God it's not Jeb Bush. Because if we get into this super clicky stuff, it's going to be brutal and ugly, and you're going to wind up with another – you're going to wind up with Jeb because he'll just stand aside while everybody slaughters each other, and he'll be the last man standing. Not because he's best or campaigned the best, but because he allowed all the grassroots to basically slaughter each other. And that's just insane.
And that's where we can fight against that. I can't control what anybody else does, but I can control what I fall for, what stories I share and give a megaphone to, and I can make sure that if I am sharing a story that is about people fighting against each other, the intro I'm putting on it is maybe something that's a little gentler or softer. I can only do my part at making sure I don't fall into it, because I fell into it last time. You know, we all do, and we all do the easy way of defending our guy and attacking the other one. We all fall into that, and it's just going to be a little bit harder work for us to put out the kind of message that we want others to try to emulate.
Can I say real quick, Corey made a point in the chat, which is very true, and that in 2012, it got really vicious between, different candidate supporters, Gingrich, Romney, Santorum. I don't think it's going to be like that this time, because I think there's pretty widespread agreement about Rubio. I think most Republicans and I think most conservatives like him. Rand Paul, I think most conservatives like him. I think a lot of Republicans like him. Ted Cruz, that may be a little bit different. I think we know that certain types of Republicans don't like him. Conservatives love him. Scott Walker, I think conservatives like him. I think most Republicans like him. So for me, I don't think it's going to be like that in 2012. As I said, and I mean, it may be unfair of me to say it, I think if anybody's going to get nasty, it's Jeb Bush, because I think Jeb Bush's only route to victory here in a primary is to have to try to go after, whoever's the favorite and try to pull them down and present himself as the alternative to the favorite. And I think that's his play. Try to win this nomination, and it's not going to be easy for him, because again, I don't think you're going to see a lot of that stuff between at least the four candidates I previously mentioned. I don't think you're going to see that kind of nastiness between them. At least that's my hope, but that's also my belief.
Right, and as we've said, the real big question is going to be not so much the candidates themselves, as much as it's going to be the media talking heads and the supporters and what the supporters do and the supporters in the media as well and what jabs they make and what kind of stuff they decide to attack the rest of the candidates with. It's annoying and certainly something that hopefully we can avoid this go round. We've said it a bunch of times here on the Refinery, we have a bunch of great candidates. We have a bunch of great candidates, and as long as we don't destroy them, we'll be in a good position to run against whoever the Democrat is in 2016. It's just we have to be sure to not kill our own guys before we have a chance to set up against the Democrats. That's all that we have to do. I don't know. I know everybody hates talking about 2016. And I think that we should probably move on to the next story, which is almost as frustrating. It's actually really insane. In an environment where the economy is bad and we have, so much unemployment and talk about, especially, we've talked about the past couple of episodes, how bad the unemployment rate is in the African American community, in inner cities. It's ridiculous how bad the unemployment is. When you go into the federal sector, when you go into the public sector, the jobs and the salaries are insane. this article that Fishy shared, you have instances where there are people who are making $85,000 a year. $85,000 a year buffing and polishing at the U.S. Mint. That's 85 grand.
Oh, yeah. It gets worse. The article went into how many federal employees there are. It's something like 2.7 million with 600,000 or so being postal employees. But when you look at where the 1% is, economics in the dictates of what you have to earn is somewhere in the neighborhood of 300,000 and some change to be in part of the 1% wealthiest. There are several medical officers in the Veterans Administration that are part of the 1%. There are 6,100 or so federal workers that are earning more than $250,000 a year. There are 17,000 or so who are earning over $200,000 a year. And agencies like the National Endowment for the Humanities, almost half of their employees are paid over $100,000. The argument here is that free markets wouldn't support these salaries. It's only federal government salaries that are earning this much. Some people for laundry, doing laundry, were making over $100,000 a year to do that based on their base salary of $37,000 or something like that, but on overtime as well, where they were paid time and a half. They would have worked 100-hour weeks in order to get that sort of money. But it's
or they would have claimed that they worked 100-hour weeks.
Thank you. That's the question. So they had done some research about this. When you are asking people in this country to pay $100,000, $200,000, $250,000, $370,000 for employees of the federal government, you had better be giving them something worth it. Do you think the VA has the reputation for excellence that would allow them to attract people that would earn $300,000 a year for medical officers, whatever that might be? I think the VA has got a pretty bad reputation for buffing and polishing coins. These are not jobs you can get outside the government. Doing laundry for $100,000 a year, you can't get that job in the free market, in the regular market. And yet we're asking people to do with less. We're cutting benefits here and there for all sorts of people. We are talking about austerity measures all across the board, defense cuts here, social service cuts there, and we are paying tons of people six-figure salaries in the federal government for doing things that in the private sector are completely, completely a fraction of that.
It's now, are those numbers take-home pay and it doesn't take into account the benefits and all of the other...
Right. It's just salary.
Because it used to, when I was growing up, we were always taught that federal government employees made less in cash because they had all of these other benefits of being a federal government employee that made it be equal to the high salary you'd get on the free market. And so, right. You know, working for the federal government, even though you made less, it was still okay to try to convince people to work for the federal government. But now that's absolutely backwards. And it seems as if federal government employees are the aristocracy in this nation.
Well, I mean, this isn't just the federal government. We've seen this in state and local governments. Remember the disaster in Los Angeles with the school system, the unified school system. The head of that was making like 350 or 400 grand a year. She was making nearly twice what Obama gets as president of the United States. I mean, leader of the free world, kind of an important job. And when you go down the list in California, there are handfuls and handfuls and probably even over 100 and some people working in state or local government that are making over 200 grand a year. So you know what? Can we have a war on 1% in the government? I think that's a great idea.
Let's
fight the 1% that are in state, local, and federal government. I think
and they can't get fired like the The free market right. would have these people out if they didn't do their job. You cannot get rid of a federal employee.
There's no competitive pressure for them to improve or to, you know, to get better at their jobs or to even get a promotion. There's no competitive pressure to hold down their wages because they ask their boss to get somebody else to pay money. So it's not like, you know, in the free market, when you ask your boss for a raise, the boss is only going to do so knowing that your expenses decrease the amount of, or, you know, increase his expenses overall, and so he needs to increase his top line to match that. Whereas in the government, they never have to worry about the top line. They never have to worry about the actual value you're bringing because it's somebody else's money that they're spending on you. Why wouldn't I lobby to get all of my employees as big of a raise as I can? Because it's somebody else's money that goes to them. It doesn't affect me negatively if all of my employees make a ton of money. In the government anyway. It's just the whole market dynamics are completely backwards, and that's why the only thing that ever held down the aristocracy was that we, the plebs out here in the public, thought of them as public servants, and we treated them as our servants. They weren't exalted. They weren't looked up to. They served us. And anybody who worked for the federal government kind of had to apologize because you only worked for the federal government if you couldn't hack it out in the free world. We now have it backwards where if you're really good and successful, you've been able to make the right connections and get a federal job.
It's more than just a federal job, though. There's state jobs. There are local jobs. It's the same way. I think you need to drop the whole federal and just say a government job. I'll give you a classic example here in Texas. You have the superintendent of the Beaumont School District, okay, which for those of you not in Texas, the Beaumont School District is not a mess. It is abominable. It is probably the worst school district in all of Texas.
It has been taken over by the Texas state government.
And guess how much the superintendent was pulling down a year? In excess of $350,000.
That's because the cost of living in Beaumont is so high. It's more expensive in Beaumont than New York and stuff,
Leslie,
right?
Leslie, where do you live? Beaumont?
Beaumont, Texas?
The only place that has a lower cost of living is Orange, Texas.
Wait, how does Beaumont, Texas have the money to pay somebody $300,000 a year?
Full disclosure, I graduated from that district. My family is there. My sister's children go
Thank
there.
You for completely ruining my point. Now you're going to make it look like everybody bright is from Beaumont.
No,
Thank
because
you so
what
much.
Happened? No, what happened after I graduated? Well, during the time I graduated, they merged districts, so there was one district citywide. And then during that, there was shuffling of school districts. It was a lot of white flight that happened into the suburbs and the suburban schools. It is now a minority majority district, and the racial tensions in that town have been just disgusting when it comes to the school board and things like that. There's a whole bunch of layers to that town. But the fact that that guy was the highest paid superintendent in Texas, higher than Dallas, higher than Fort Worth, higher than Austin, higher than Houston, that was disgusting. Guy got
higher than anywhere.
It was so bad. There was corruption all up and down in that district. It's now been taken over and been reorganized, and people are hopeful that things will change, but it festered for so long, and nobody complained, and the people who did complain were called racists.
Yeah, racist. Okay, yeah, so pay me more money. I don't think that any superintendent anywhere should ever make more than the governor. It's obnoxious.
Or the president.
I'm going to tell you one quick anecdote about that town.
I think the president makes more than that, but anyway.
There was a black coach that had been accused of some kind of inappropriate relationship with a student or something, and apparently was, if I remember this right, was found in the closet of the young girl, if I'm not mistaken, and the lady went to the district, the mom went to the district, and they told her, you do not want to make trouble for a black man in this district.
Classic. Classic.
I'm just saying.
Oh, boy. This is terrible, and I'm sure we're going to all get called racist for this. It's inevitable. And speaking of things that are racist, let's shift over to the second ridiculous spending story that we have on the docket tonight, and that is, I mean, as bad as this last one was about federal employees, this one is worse because it keeps people in poverty because it's keeping them, happy. I mean, it's the government is paying to house poor people in luxury apartments with pools and wine cellars.
Now, this is how it works. Okay. So building developers, I wrote this down. Building developers get tax write-offs for putting low-income sections of housing in their new developments, typically their luxury apartments. Section 8 will pay the portion of the rent. The resident pays 30% of their income. Section 8 covers the rest. The government pays the remainder, and even if it's up $1,000 for a place, as long as the resident is paying 30% of their income. If the person's income goes up and a significant amount, they are evicted. They are taken off the program. Meanwhile, the government is spending a ton subsidizing housing for, say, one family in a luxury apartment, while there are people on wait lists for years who cannot get housing at all. That's the scam. And the article that we have on this talks about it as entrapment into poverty, because they can get into a nice place, but they can't earn enough to do it themselves, so it disincentivizes them from getting more employment, getting better employment, ever getting out of government assistance. And these guys are getting tax credits of $1 of tax credit worth every dollar they spend on low-income housing.
And we wonder. So
it's basically cronyism kind of thing? It's a taxpayer subsidy for the rich real estate developers.
Yes, and in addition to that, it keeps people who, you know, might otherwise be able to move out of the lower income bracket that they're in into a, actually make more money and do better for themselves and for their families. But when the options that you're presented with are, okay, make less money and stay in an awesome house, in an awesome apartment with a pool and all sorts of benefits and stuff, or make more money, have to move out of this awesome apartment and get no assistance from the government. I mean, if you are somebody who is in that economic situation and you have to make that choice for yourself and for your family, what are you going to? Are you stupid? No, you're going to go for the one that gives you the most benefits.
And you're going to work under the table. You'll increase your income through non-official means. Because you want to increase your income, and they're not deadbeats sitting there on the couch. They're increasing their income in a way that's not reportable to the federal government, that doesn't impact their ability to get federal subsidies.
And we are stuck with this perpetual situation where nobody ever moves out, or upward mobility. Yeah, in economic sense it's dying. It's
impossible. Yeah,
falling apart.
And to tie that back to when I've been saying we need to get into these programs and make them work smarter. This is a prime example of a bunch of waste and a bunch of cronyism and subsidies to rich folks who are developing buildings and not helping the poor that it's intended to help. This is a government transfer of wealth from people paying taxes to rich developers. And
okay,
if we can point that out and make that case while expanding the opportunity to get more people off those wait lists and into government housing, and then having that penalty eased where they begin to make more money, maybe they just end up paying more of the rent a little
right.
bit. not exact one-on-one based on what they're making, but a little higher percentage each time, and actually have some progress. This is a really easy system, easy fix here for conservatives to sell based on the waste and the cronyism involved in this program.
This reminds me, or it brings some truth to an episode that I recently saw of, I forget what crime show it was, but it was about the poor door. There was a crime that happened in an upscale apartment complex in New York City, only it was the murder victim was on the poor side of this upscale apartment complex, and it was a separate entrance that the subsidized people lived in, and then the rich people were in the door, next door. Maybe they shared a wall, but the expensive developer had the rich people living on this side, and there were hundreds of them in the penthouses and all of that, but then they had the poor door that the subsidized people lived in, and now it makes sense. I didn't understand why that was a thing in New York, but apparently it's enough of a known thing that it made an episode of TV in one of the crime dramas where they were talking about the poor door. And yes, it's great that poor people can find housing, but talk about discriminating. Talk about indentured servitude, basically. We've got the poor people are servants to the rich people, even though they're not directly working for them. The poor people, by living there, are allowing those rich people to have that housing, because that maybe the real estate developer wouldn't have gotten the permit to build that housing without also saying, oh yes, I'm also putting low rent housing in here. Oh, and give me my tax credits while I'm at it. So that developer gets kudos for however many units of low-income housing he's creating, and he's considered somebody who is taking care of the poor, and he's a good guy. But he's getting tax credits, and he's really hanging out with the rich people, and he makes the poor people enter through a separate door.
And if I may, I've had this idea for a while, but I'm going to postulate it here, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but this really is basically a form of slavery. It really is. It's the new slavery. And I really feel like there's two forms of it. There's one, people who work for a living, I'll include myself in that, who are taxed so heavily that getting ahead becomes nigh unto impossible unless you hit the jackpot of sorts. And that is your tax burden is so high that you basically are a slave to the system, because you have to work to be able to live. But your money is essentially going to pay other people. And then you have, of course, these poor people living in this, Section 8 housing that, and I'm never going to get over the fact that it says Section 8. I'm sorry, Section 8 to me is completely different. Section 8 for me. Section 8 was crazy. Compliments to the military. Anyway, you basically have a form of slavery in America. It's just not called that. But when you basically strip away the opportunities for people to get ahead, you have basically relegated them to slavery, servitude. We just don't call it that. We just say, oh, they're the poor. We're helping them out.
That's kind of charged with emotion, and that's not a good look for a bunch of white people to be talking about it that way, I don't think. But the concept, I think, is sound.
So I'm not off base then?
No.
Instead of saying slavery, you just say it's exploitative, and that's a good word these days. That's a word that you can use, and it has the right connotations. So
here's exploitative. A quote from the article I wanted to go into. They're building luxury housing for poor people because they think it's a neat idea that makes them feel good. What you have is a corrupt log rolling between big developers and the bureaucracy, and they feed off each other. They get a tax write-off for putting a limited number of low-income units into a luxury building. Now, if all the luxury building you're getting, by the way, in building in New York, all the building you're getting for new housing is luxury building, then you are going to squeeze the poor out of New York City altogether, unless you have some of this housing allocated for them. But that's a New York City policy on rent control that's governing that, and luxury buildings are exempt. So the only way you're going to get new construction and poor people in that new construction is to do these set-asides. It's because they've created so many regulations. This is how it works. It is a shame, and you're right, it's exploitative of the poor. It is crushing and disincentivizing them from ever being able to crawl out from under the government's thumb.
The rich keep getting richer, and the poor stay exactly as poor as they are.
Or poorer. And take a guess about racially what the percentage there, who's getting screwed the most, I'm sure.
And think, for every person in a luxury apartment, which is a great thing for them, obviously, in terms of their surroundings and the neighborhood that they're in, for every person in a luxury apartment, there are many on a waiting list who are not getting help at all.
And what's the carbon footprint of all those people in the luxury apartments? Do they spend part of the money from their luxury apartments buying the offsets or going to their expensive global warming charity banquet things to donate money?
It's okay, Leslie. Their footprint small because they have sandals.
This is disturbing. All of these facts and the corruption, all of this. I need a safe space. Can somebody please provide a safe space for me? I need a safe space.
Are you having a trigger warning here? Is this a trigger situation?
I've been triggered, and I'm. I need a. No, don't clap. For the love of God, don't clap. Jazz hands.
By the way, I just want to point this out before we leave this story. This is on top of having banks giving loans to people who couldn't afford to buy houses and having these subprime mortgages that led to the terrible crisis in 2008. So we've made that mistake and nearly wrecked the economy, and nearly took the entire banking system down, and now we're doing this. That really is amazing.
George, you're fired. You're never coming back on the show again. I had set up an awesome transition, and you just crushed it. You crushed it, George.
I'll start clapping again.
Stop. Let's not joke. Please, no clapping. Anyway, this is disgusting. This is... There are a few things. It's always my generation that gets blamed for stuff because we're not blamed for stuff, but we're cited as just the worst, and we kind of are. And this story is a reason why.
To be fair, you guys are convenient to blame. Just saying. I'm just gonna put that out there.
Yeah, I don't know how this story, it's amazing. How I don't know how it snuck into the New York Times, because it's actually a decent piece. No, of course we always read varied sources here, and this was a really good story in the New York Times by Judith Schulwitz, I think her name is. And it's called In College and Hiding from Scary Ideas. And reading it the first time, I knew it was bad. I knew it was really bad on the liberal campuses, but maybe I didn't realize it was this bad. The kind of, we talk about bubbling a lot here on the Refinery, how on our side we have a lot of people who, hate liberalism, hate all this stuff, hate all the bad stuff associated with the left culture, that they curl up into a defensive bubble and they, live in sort of gated communities of conservatism and try and escape the leftist ideology in every form through TV and movies and all that stuff. Well, the left is doing that too, but it's on college campuses, and they are making people into infants. They are I actually used this word in a conversation with Fishy as we were discussing before I read it in the article itself. Self infantilization is what's going on here on these college campuses. Fishy, you found this thing first. Please.
The idea is that when there are controversial subjects and topics that are going to come up, whether it's rape or violence or something, race is a topic sometimes on campus, that there ought to be a safe space so that people don't have to be confronted with, and here's the quote from one of the women who felt, I guess, aggressed against, "I was feeling bombarded by a lot of viewpoints that really go against my dearly and closely held beliefs." That was her reaction to a particular speaker being invited on campus. And, you know, my thought in response to that was, so does every conservative in this country every damn day. Okay, we feel like that every day. But these college students want to have a place to insulate themselves from things. My first response was, where is Chaka Khan? I'm every woman. Feminism brand from the 70s. Didn't we all talk about feminist empowering and that women could do so many things? They could go exactly into fields that they had never attempted before. And I'm going to say this and then I'm just going to open it up to everybody, but air conditioning is a great thing. It's beautiful and you need it in Texas because it's so hot here. And it's lovely, but it's artificial. It's not the real nature of things. And when you go outside, you are going to broil. And you can take the choice to never go outside and to stay in the air conditioning, but you'll never get anywhere.
I can bring home the bacon, fry it up in a pan, and never ever let you forget your man. Yeah, that's the feminism I grew up with. And college was the place that you went to get out of your bubble, because all through elementary and junior high and high school, you were with the people who lived in your neighborhood, who were basically the same socioeconomic class as you. They were all from the same town. We had the same shared experiences. So you went to college to meet people who had totally different experiences from you and totally different ideas, and you were to be presented with totally different ideas and thoughts and concepts from your professors, and the idea was that you would be challenged and you would grow as a person and be able to handle real life a little bit better for the experience of having been in college. And also, really primarily, it was about the things that you were supposed to actually learn in classes. But that's how old-fashioned I am. I think you're supposed to learn in classes. It's a kind of hue to that concept. And I know that makes me hopelessly outdated, and JD would just laugh and laugh and laugh because nobody learns in class anymore. It's more about experiencing your feelings and discussing how it makes you feel and if you feel microaggressed against or whatever. But yeah, it is the infantilization of an entire generation. They seem not just unwilling it's a lack of curiosity, and wasn't George Bush criticized for being uncurious? There's an entire generation of people who don't want to be challenged. They don't want to learn anything they don't already know.
The way I see it, they want to demand the protection of children, but they want the privileges and liberties of an adult.
Right, right.
I have a question. When did expressing a differing opinion on, say, the rape culture or sexual assault or these things? Because I'm looking through this story now, and I'm reading the part about the professor at Northwestern who was being protested because she wrote something contrary to, I guess, what folks felt about the safe space. When did that become erasing someone's experience? When did that become diminishing somebody who actually was raped? Because I don't see how that works. I don't quite understand how
the
ridiculing
phrase,
the safe space thing, means, oh, you think you're diminishing someone's rape, because that's just not so.
The phrase that they use, I think, is invalidating someone because you disagree agree with them. Their ideas are invalid. They make you feel invalid. Where in real life, or in our time growing up, we would have called that debate.
Well, and I want to add this too. You know who really feels invalidated? You know who really feels, who really doesn't have a safe space? Somebody that's a member of a fraternity on the campus of the University of Virginia.
God, no kidding.
Because they had been smeared as a bunch of Neanderthals and thugs and rapists for how many months? They had every fraternity was shut. They shut them all down after this story came out.
And the sororities too, didn't they?
Yeah, oh, yes. The whole Greek life thing. Now, that's something I never took part in, so it that didn't register with me. But just imagine being in the fraternity that was mentioned in that story and have people looking at you going, maybe you're the one that did that to that woman. Maybe you're the one that... Even if you're feeling invalid,
you hang out with them, you're friends with them, so you probably are a rapist, or you would have been, you just maybe weren't there. I mean, the assumptions are, if you are in any way associated with anything that has to do with that horrible rape fraternity, and it was all a lie.
But my other thing, too, is that what kind of women are we sending out into the world? These are women that I presume want to change things for the better. If they can't handle an opposing idea on campus, how in the world are they going to handle the real world and challenging people in a law firm or in a boardroom or in politics? Seriously, we can't treat everybody like a special sunflower.
They demand.
Wait till they meet me. God help them.
They demand the statement that they are equal, but they behave in a way that is in no way equal. They behave like babies, but then insist that they are equal to any man or any other sane, rational adult. But those are not strong, equal women. And it was years ago at Harvard where some woman had to leave because she felt faint because the president of Harvard said that men and women think differently. And she, oh my God, that's so crazy! I had to leave because I got the vapors. I might faint. Well,
Victorians,
honey,
fainting couches.
Exactly. Sack up.
Did you just say that? Did you actually just say that?
I'm glad she said it. Huff it up,
because I'm glad she did, because I was sitting here going, I can't say what I'm actually thinking because I might offend somebody. Because what I'm really thinking is to drag out a whole bunch of profanity and be like, you know, you join the military. Oh, wait, that's right. They're neutering the military, so you can't even say swear words anymore because you need a timeout because it's a little stressful. I've always wanted to know these people that, you know, are so special that can't handle an opposing opinion. How would you handle combat? No, seriously, yeah. That's my question. Oh, I need a timeout. People disagree with me with a gun.
Aren't you glad that the draft is done, that there is no draft because of that? Oh, my stars. The people that we do have serving, I don't have to worry about those people.
But don't you think that this generation...
There are some you need to worry about. I'm sorry, but...
There are some people in the military that are not... not right.
Leave it at that.
Great. Now we're going to get dinged for that, too.
Sure. I think that this generation, there hasn't been enough challenge or pressure against them in any real way. I mean, they really haven't faced hardship or fear or consequences of in any real way. And I think I don't blame them. They are the children of privilege and safety and luxury and plenty. And as a result, you get children who want to stay children forever. And when the pressure comes and when the hard times come, which they will shortly, I think they will step up, and I think we will discover that there's a lot more to this hipster generation than they're displaying right now. I think they'll be forced to. But, you know, you're only really as tough as the circumstances demand. And right now the circumstances of America for the vast majority of hipsters, not poor young 20s, because those people are living in poverty and dealing with poverty. I'm talking about the rich middle-class hipsters. They've never had to, they haven't had to work to pay for the clothes that they wear to high school. They've had to maybe work to pay for all the apps they want to get on their iPhone. They're just, and they haven't had the constant fear that Felicia and I had, that they weren't trained to hear that siren and duck under the desk because the bomb was coming at you. There's a certain pressure that you live with when you grow up in the Cold War that makes you just ever so slightly stronger. We weren't anything like our parents' generation or those before us.
We did, however, see some planes crash into some buildings. So,
but did that didn't really materially affect very many people at all? It really did not.
I know a lot of people who have been really materially affected by it, but
well hang on.
Sorry.
All right, go ahead.
Shailene Woodley, we have to do this before my generation gets besmirched even farther.
I wasn't going to be smirched. I was just going to make a point about something else.
Okay. But seriously, with Shailene Woodley, we actually have somebody who is from my generation that, you know, is actually halfway, you know, salient, makes a good point. She has rejected the feminist label on several occasions now, and she's pointed the argument from, hey, you're spending all of this time and effort, all of these comments on whether or not I'm a feminist or whether I should be embracing of the feminist label, and that's time that you could have spent on genocide. You know, that's time that you could have spent on stuff that's actually happening. You know, what's going on in Africa every day and the kind of craziness that's going on there, that's real feminism activity to me. I mean, that to me is something that an actual feminist would care about, is the real plight of women in these intolerable conditions, not what's going on a college campus right now. There's nothing about being triggered by clapping that's anywhere near close to what's going on when Boko Haram is next door to you and, you know, taking girls that are your age. It's absolutely insane, and Shailene Woodley pointed that out. And so we actually do have some halfway decent millennials here. Sorry, I just needed to get that off my chest because, you know, I can't, it's my generation.
You've got guys your generation that are winning the Medal of Honor. I'm not going to sit there and argue with that. I'm not going to sit there and say, oh, well, your entire generation is just a bunch of wimps. no, my point that I wanted to make is that the difference between where your generation lies and where my generation came from, and there is some substantial differences, but one of the things that I noticed growing up is that we had a lot of people that we looked to as heroes, people that we idolized and that pop culture idolized. For instance, John Wayne. John Wayne was espoused, and so you also had with respect, my generation was much, much closer to what they call the greatest generation and those that served in World War II. And so they were deeply idolized. In fact, it was because of those men that I did serve in the military. And so when you start to get further and further away from that, you start to get further and further away from those things that were important. Now I realize the culture has changed, so there is some of that, but the point is still the same, and that is what each generation upholds as the standard. If that had continued to follow, then you would have had the same results with your generation that you would have had with my generation. On the other hand, I'm not entirely certain that my generation is anybody that, you know, you should be upholding as a salient standard for you know what to do. Although I'd argue that the baby boomers are the absolute worst. I'd rather take the hipsters of today than the boomers of yesterday. God, those guys are just terrible. And I think I'm supposed to make a short joke or something right now. So I look around for Fishy, but my neck hurts, so I can't look down. Anyway, there's your short joke. Boom.
That was a microaggression.
Micro. Well, you know what? It's curious. You have to give me credit. I am a tall man, and I also happen to be big, and yet I've expanded myself to be able to make a microaggression rather than a macro. I'm just pointing that out.
I need a safe space, and I'm going to close this show so that I can have one. In the meantime, thank you to everybody who has been in the chat tonight with us. We have had so many things that we threw at you. Hopefully, though, you had some fun, learned a little bit, got a little upset, and figured out maybe something you could do about it. We are always, always, always putting out videos on the Conservative Union YouTube channel. Make sure you check those out. They're a little bit shorter than an hour and a half, so you can zip through one of those in a few minutes and share those around. And if you like what we're doing here, tell people about it. We really appreciate the support. We have so many people that we've gotten to be regulars of the show now, just even through just clips. It's been great. You can find everything at therefinerieshow.com. Thursday, the podcast hits both there and at Vigilant Liberty Radio. And let's see, what else am I missing, guys?
Anything? Foreign Matters.
Yes! Oh, yes! George is hosting Foreign Matters since Peter is taking a leave of absence. So George and Stefan will be back this Thursday, provided that sportsing does not get in the way.
And it won't.
And okay, good, it won't. So I'm sure there'll be some talk about George's part of the piece on Yemen in there as well. That seems to be heating up big time. That is, if I'm not mistaken, 10 on Thursdays at Eastern Time on Spreecast. You can find anything you want to know about that at Free Radical Network, a Facebook page, or Foreign Matters Facebook page. Go like those pages. Conservative Union and the Party of Choice have Facebook pages as well. Go check those out. Anything else, or am I done with you guys for the night?
I just want to mention one thing with respect to George. I want to go ahead and push Foreign Matters, but and for the most part, I do agree with him that Sportstein will not interrupt, but there may be throughout the show, having done this before, random shouts of, yes, or what are you thinking, as they talk about Crimea. So please understand it may be sports related, George will be the absolute professional, but that may occur. And Crayon, I absolutely love him, but I know he's going to do this because Duke's still in. So,
they'll be cheering on foreign policy decisions or something.
Well, what may end up happening is that George will be making a critical point about Crimea or Russia or ISIS or something, about how, it's critical that we need to do something, and Crayon's probably going to be like, yes! So my hope is that his cheers add to the conversation as opposed to detract, where he's trying to say, no, we need to stand up to this guy, or this is awful.
You said a lot of words, none of which, after you got sportsing and team out, none of which penetrated, sorry. So, yeah, folks, check out Foreign Matters.
I didn't
want
to talk down to you.
Oh, there it is again. Microaggression.